I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week are freelance writer Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney and editor Arsalan Iftikhar, political science professor Lester Spence, and reporter Quinn Kleinfelter of public radio station WDET in Detroit. I may jump in here or there, but for now, take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, yo, fellas, what's up? Welcome to the shop.
Hey.
Hey, what's up?
Hey.
Q, what's up, man? First time in. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
You know what? Check this out. President Obama sat down with Vice President Biden, Sergeant James Crowley, and Dr. Henry Skip Gates to bury the hatchet. Now, there's also rumors flying that the Budweiser Frogs and Spuds McKenzie, they're on their way to the Middle East to try to reinvigorate that peace process as well.
Nice.
While Skip and Crowley and Obama had, you know, the traditional brews, Biden went non-alcoholic, not for nothing, right? We got some tape on this, right?
Yeah, well, actually, we do. The President Obama and Vice President Biden didn't talk about the discussion afterwards. You can see why. But Sergeant Crowley gave a press conference after the get-together, and this is what he said.
I think what was accomplished was this was a positive step in moving forward as opposed to reliving the events of the past couple of weeks in an effort to move not just the city of Cambridge or two individuals past this event, but the whole country.
Wow. And there you have it. And we didn't hear from Professor Gates yet. I'm going to call him Professor Gates. I don't know. Obviously, he and Jimmy are very intimate in a way that I wasn't aware of. But we haven't heard from him yet. Skip, but I assume we will. Here you go.
Yeah, me and Skip. Thank you, Michelle. Me and Skip go about 10 years back to Africana.com. What's up, Skip? Yo, and he also has a piece right now entitled Something About the Happy Accident. It's on TheRoot.com where he does talk about his experience with the beer. You know, I'm wondering if people missed the teachable moment. Q, what did you think? Q, you there?
Oh, yeah. Right, hey, I don't know. I think for one thing, it's about as good of sponsorship that you get for Bud Light as anything, right? I mean, how much does it cost to get a presidential spokesperson to begin with?
Right.
But, you know, a lot of people here have been interested in it, but they also are a little bit iffy on whether or not, the racial element to it is all that it's being made out to be, really.
Really? Why you say that?
Well, because, you know, there's a lot of people here that will look at this with kind of a sad resignation. They see it all the time. You know, racial profiling is almost a part of the fabric of Detroit in some ways, at least according to many people. You know, whether you're trying to find an apartment, redlining with insurance rates, etc. But as you talked about a little earlier in the program, they kind of tend to think that a lot of times it has to do with the police, you know, and you don't mess with the police. And it makes sense that the professor would get a bit belligerent trying to get into his own house. But when the police try to clamp down on you, most everybody I talk to say, boy, that guy shouldn't have really been trying to push it.
Well, yeah, there's that. Dr. Spence.
Well, first, what would have really impressed me if they'd have cracked a nice bottle of Wild Irish Rose instead of drinking beer. You know, I mean, go old school, all the way back.
Right.
If you were to do it, right?
Right,
Wild Irish
right,
Rose.
Right, right.
But
pour a little taste
me,
on the ground for the ancestors, right?
Straight up, pour out a little liquor for the people who are, you know, for the ancestors, right?
Shout out to Cooley High. Go ahead.
Yeah,
go ahead,
straight
man.
Up. What I've been trying, because I teach racial politics and black politics, like, for a living. For me, like, these conversations are things that I've been having. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to be open to the possibility that these conversations are helpful, but at the same time still be critical of this approach where we think if we just bring black people and white people together in a room and talk about quote-unquote race as opposed to really politically organizing against racism is the solution to the problem, right? So to that extent, you know, I'm glad Obama brought them together, but I really wished that they would have talked more about politics and he would have created more of a space to talk about police brutality and the types of stuff that Quinn is talking about. Shouts out to the 313.
He gets to that on his piece on the route that was actually entitled An Accident of Place and Time. A-Train, I know you saw it. What did you think?
Well, you know, some people called it the Beer Summit. Some people called it the Beer Stroika, the Audacity of Hops. one story that I think unfortunately got drowned out, was the recent case of Cambridge police officer Justin Barrett, who had—
Across the river, but different department.
Right. Boston police officer Justin Barrett, who had sent an email to some Boston Globe colonists and some other federal National Guard servicemen where he called Professor Gates a, quote, banana-eating jungle monkey. He was, of course, then put on administrative leave. Now there's a termination hearing that's going to come in the near future. But, you know, I think that, you know, with this Perestroika that we had at the Rose Garden, you know, there are, you know, really tangible issues of racism within the Boston Police Department and around the country that we do need to address.
You know what? That email comes to me. It comes under the heading of one bad apple, bro. I mean, I don't know that we can safely extrapolate the attitude of a whole department from one email. I mean,
it is interesting,
but
though. But it is interesting to me that the guy says that the officer says that he didn't mean to be offensive. I'm sorry.
Like he would have.
What would you have said if you had meant to be offensive?
Well, no,
officer.
What else is he going to say?
I'm puzzled by this.
You know, what else is he going to say?
Well, he sent this to a Boston Globe columnist and numerous other individuals, and now is shocked that it became public.
I think we would hear a lot of honestly, like it. He would never have referred to a white person as a banana-eating jungle monkey. I think that is pretty safe to assume, and I think so. It's pretty transparent.
But this does – I think this does lead to and if you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with journalists Jimmy Israel, Arsalan Iftikhar, Quinn Kleinfelter, and Professor Lester Spence in the barbershop. But it does lead to this other thing we wanted to talk about, which we talked about earlier in the week – the kinds of conversations that have been stirred up by this incident. Some of it, I think some people have found it very refreshing. They get a chance to say some things that they would like to say. But some of it has taken a very ugly turn at some points. Like, for example, The Root, Jimmy, for which you are a contributor, Henry Louis Gates is the editor-in-chief, had been deluged by very racist comments over the course of the week. And I'm just... I don't know. I'm just interested to hear what people think that says, if anything, or if people just need an outlet.
Well, you know, for me, I mean, because, you know, I've been doing this internet thing for a minute, and I'm used to people coming at me. I'm used to getting death threats in my comments and also my personal email box. You know, and people feel like the anonymity of the internet gives them the ability to just kind of lob grenades from behind, you know, brick walls. And I always tell people, I'm like, look, you know, because I address my commenters very often. It's certainly if they address me personally, and I say, look, yeah, you don't know my mother, so don't let's not go there. You know, but if you want to attack me personally, you know, attack my work. You know, because you don't know me personally.
But you don't have a problem with well, let me just play a short clip from Terrence Samuel, the deputy editor of The Root. He was on the program, and this is what he said.
What you saw here is a fair number of people who just kind of came into the conversation willy nilly. And if you're going to have a conversation about race, sadly, you're going to have to sometimes talk to racists.
I thought that was a very interesting point.
Right.
Yeah, T. Sam, you'll hit it right on the head.
But his argument is you have to open it up. Anyway, Arsalan, what were you saying?
Well, you know, I give Jimmy Mad props for, you know, addressing, you know, the people in his comment section. Because for a lot of people, you know, the comment sections of websites tend to be the lowest common denominator of the internet. I mean, you know, you can see YouTube comments. You know, a lot of times, like Jimmy said, you know, people hiding behind the anonymity, you know, of the internet, you know, are able to sit in their tidy whities and in their basement, you know, lobbying ad hominem and racist attacks.
But can I ask you, in addition to being a journalist, you're a civil rights attorney. Mm-hmm. That was kind of your first life.
Right.
What about the free speech aspect of it? I mean, I feel differently about news organizations.
Absolutely.
I mean, these are people have a right to set the terms of discussion. I mean, we don't print, you know, false information knowingly. So those are the terms. So I think people have a right to say. But what about the whole question of whether there are rules of civility that should be adhered to? What do you think about that? Because I can tell you this police officer is also making a free speech argument.
Absolutely.
Where some people are making it on his behalf. They're saying, I can say what I want.
And you're absolutely right, Michelle. You know, the First Amendment does fully allow for any racist or bigoted, you know, thoughts or comments to be made where the legal lines could be crossed are, you know, for example, if you make a death threat towards someone or you make defamatory or libelous statements, which can be actionable in a court of law. And, you know, we see a lot of these comments cross over into those lines where they are either, you know, they're making threats of physical, you know, harm, or they are into the defamation or libel.
But are those kinds of racist comments, calling somebody a banana-eating jungle monkey, is that by definition defamatory?
No, it's not. A defamatory statement is one that can be proved factually false. So, you know, if somebody went on and said that Arsalan is a woman, that is a factually incorrect statement that can be proven to be false. And so, you know, that's what defamation legal claims in a civil court are there to remedy.
But that's tricky to me because, Jimmy, I'm curious about your take on this because there are times when people have gotten into disputes with you online about things, and you've been very stung by it because you think you're having a vigorous discussion, and they feel offended and attacked by it. And I'm just interested where you think the line should be. And I will say, I will bring gender into it because I think, well, you say it goes both ways, right?
Oh,
but I do think that, on the one hand, you want to invite people into the space. On the other hand, some people, by the definition of that kind of conversation, will be chased out. So
Well, there's been instances when colleagues and other bloggers have gotten at me, and I either address those or I don't. If I think they're making a salient point, you know, I'll let it go. And even if I don't think they're making a salient point, the line through their teeth, I'm going to let it go too. You know, but, you know, for the most part, you know, I'm open to engaging anybody that wants to engage me about my work. You know, if you start trying to get at me personally, that's where you're going to have a personal problem, you know, because you don't know me personally. So what's the point of that? You know, so I handle it kind of on the by case basis, you know. So you gotta, yeah, it's case by case.
But here's what we find in matters of race: a lot of people don't care what the facts are. They don't care what the facts are. Yeah. They just want to say what they want to say. I mean, one of the things I have found difficult over the years as a journalist is that you can constantly address these issues. Like, there's more minorities on welfare than whites. That is simply not true. Just on the numbers, people don't care. And then you report what is true, and people say, oh, that's not true. You're lying, or you're censoring them. It's just a very, I don't know, Quinn, what's your take on this?
Well, you know, I think that there is a good reason to have an open debate and so on. I mean, even if it is, you know, just abhorrent comments, because that's supposed to be part of the melting pot idea, right? I mean, you bring all these comments together, and then, you know, you let somebody basically hang themselves if they're going to say stuff, and people kind of comment on it. I think in the racial aspect, though, it gets to be a little bit tough just because of some of the inbuilt things. You know, around here, I mean, in Detroit, right, a massively African-American population, I'll sit and talk to people, and you just, you know, talk like normal humans after a while. But that first look at somebody, I'll ride a Detroit bus, for example, right? I'll be the only white guy on it. Nobody will sit with me. You know, and I haven't talked. I haven't done. I swear. Man. You know, I'll brush off the seat. I keep sniffing. You know, I've used my deodorant.
I'll sit with you, Quinn.
I'll sit with you, Quinn.
You know, because I'm the minority, and so it's very easy to see how that gets thrown at somebody right off the bat. Yet you sit and talk to somebody across the aisle for like 2 seconds, and suddenly you're just connecting like that. It's this very individual thing. And if anything comes out really good out of this whole Gates and Crowley situation, it would be just being able to have a connection one on one with somebody else to realize that maybe there's more that brings people together than would actually divide them.
You know what? These commenters sometimes kind of make me sick, and I wish my medical coverage covered it. You know, but you know,
that's a transition.
That's a nice segue.
You know, very nice.
It's interesting how Obama's having a hard time selling his health care overhaul to rural America. Now that's really intriguing for me. And we got a little bit of tape on that.
You know, this is one of the interesting things about this, and one of the questions I'm curious about is whether, at the end of the day, this was a productive interaction or not, whether this whole episode was productive or not. There's some evidence that it isn't clear whether you can tie to this, but it's clear that Obama's favorability ratings are sliding. And it'd be interesting to see to me whether part of it is that the white population who are tenuous supporters or indifferent to him are now taking a cue from this. And for example, we have a clip from a piece that we had on Morning Edition, where a man named Ricky Drake, who's unemployed, who's disabled, uses Medicaid, talks about why he is not supporting health care reform, even though you would think he'd be somebody who'd benefit from it. Here's what he had to say.
The health care plan he's got, Obama, is going to hurt people in the long run. Minority is going to get more attention than the whites and stuff like that. That's the way I take it from what the news was talking about.
Wow. Wow. Thanks for that, Michelle. That's deep, you know, and it's deep even given specifically that the Wall Street Journal says 46 million people don't have health care and 14,000 people a day are losing it because they're getting their jobs cut. Dr. Spence, drop some science on us, please.
So this is very much related to the last conversation we had. So what's happening is you've got over 40 years of miseducation about the role of government in general, and in this case, the role of government in healthcare. So in this case, what he's trying to do is he's trying to have a conversation when what really needs to happen is education, right? So he's creating this space where now people feel like they have the ability or the interest just to shout out untruths or to shout out what they think is right, but actually is not. but there is not at the same time a space created where people can be critically educated. In this case, this guy is clearly going against his own interests in large part because of a combination of conservatism and racism. And that's the thing we have to begin to create the space to educate people about instead of just talking to people and creating like conversation spaces.
Q, you've done a lot of reporting on this. Chime in here.
Well, yeah, you know, in terms of the unemployment situation, I mean, Detroit is ground zero, right, in terms of just how high the unemployment rate is and the drop in manufacturing. When they talk about the healthcare issue, a lot of Obama officials have been through here pushing it, and you'll hear the criticism that, hey, he's going too fast, he's trying to do too much too soon. Here, they don't say that at all. They want it done now. People are losing insurance left and right as they go, and they need something to try to keep it. At the same time, I found actually a different take that I was a little surprised about, and that comes from my own personal experience because my mom has had some pretty severe health issues over the last 3 or 4 months, and so I've talked to more physicians than I probably ever had in my life. And a number of them are trying to relocate out of the state just because they are not making enough money. They said so many people have lost their insurance, private or paid for by the companies, that they're living off Medicare. And they said the doctors are not making enough, these doctors will say, that they're just not making enough off where Medicare is now. And if, in fact, they extend insurance coverage to cover everybody, they're going to pay for part of that by dropping back how much that they're giving in Medicare. Wow. And so these doctors are going to be making less. And so they're looking to go elsewhere. At the same time, they'll even say, but, you know, nobody's going to cry for us because we can't take that third trip to the Bahamas
this year.
That's crazy.
Wow.
Right.
Thanks, Clint.
Let the healing begin. Go ahead, Michelle. This is all you.
All right. Thank you all. Jimmy Israel is a freelance journalist who writes for TheRoot.com. He's a guest lecturer and presidential fellow at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. And he joined us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Quinn Kleinfelder is a reporter with WDET in Detroit, and he joined us from there. Lester Spence is a political science professor at Johns Hopkins University, and he joined us from WYPR in Baltimore. And Arsalan Iftikhar is the founder of TheMuslimGuy.com and a civil rights attorney, and he joined us in our studios in Washington. But before I let everybody go, we have an announcement. Vanessa Navarrete arrived yesterday at 1:15 p.m. Pacific time.
Yeah,
she weighed in at 8 pounds, 11 ounces. And Dad, barbershop regular Ruben Navarrete, tells us she is beautiful and healthy. But after nearly 24 hours in labor, Mom Veronica is tired. Our best to Ruben and Veronica. Gentlemen, thank you.
Peace.
Peace.
Yep, yep.
Under this golden dome lies an uncooked, unrisen, unbaken souffle.
You all know that voice. It's been imitated in parody on Saturday Night Live.
Cut along the backbone to the Pope's nose like so. Oh. Oh. Now I've done it. I've cut the dickens out of my finger. Well.
And in the new film that's coming out Friday.
Before she changed the world, Julia Child was just an American living in France.
Shouldn't I find something to do?
What is it that you really like to do?
Eat.
And we are so good at it.
That's Meryl Streep as Julia Child, America's beloved French chef and star of 3 TV cooking shows, all filmed in her Cambridge, Massachusetts kitchen. Just before she moved to California, Julia Child donated that entire kitchen to the Smithsonian Institution. The exhibition opened on August 15, 2002, Julia Child's 90th birthday. Curators at the National Museum of American History had reassembled the kitchen exactly as it was, except one big piece was missing. Weekend Edition food commentator Bonnie Wolf went to the museum last week to see some pots and pans.
There are 23 gleaming copper pots, 47 items altogether on the pegboard, which include things like a tin butterfly, tin fish molds, cast iron cornrow dishes, black steel pots, a pineapple corer, even a branding iron with the initials JC on it that was given to her by an admirer. And with this wall of pots and other items, Julia Child's kitchen at the museum is now whole.
Bonnie Wolf caught up with the exhibition's co-curator, Paula Johnson, who described the kitchen.
It's so amazing. This kitchen is such a simple kitchen. And now everyone has these fancy billion-dollar kitchens. And she didn't ever go that way.
It's deceptively simple. I mean, at once, it's accessible to people. I think that, you know, people look at this and they're a little surprised at how kind of ordinary it seems. there's no, you know, granite countertops here. This is what she really wanted,
butcher block. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the Garland and her relationship to the Garland stove range.
Yeah, Julia Child purchased this Garland range in the early 1950s, a used restaurant range here in Washington, D.C., and it's a six-burner. She and her husband then moved it up to Cambridge, and it was her favorite range for her entire life in Cambridge. She swore by it, never wanted to have it replaced. It served them very well, and she joked about, you know, taking it with her to her grave if they could ever find a grave big enough for the two of them.
I'm Julia Child. Bon appetit.
Writer and director Nora Ephron donated a few objects from the film to the museum. They will be housed in the museum's collection of music, sports, and entertainment history, along with Dorothy's ruby slippers and the Fonz's leather jacket. There's a scene in the movie where Julia is racing through Des Hilarins, the famous Paris cookware store where Julia did get a lot of her copper pots. She flings them into a basket, probably not the way the real Julia would have treated fine copper pots. But Julia wasn't a snob. She thought pots and pans were for cooking, not looking at. Near her stove, on more pegboard, are one or two copper pots and a lot of wherever aluminum cookware from the hardware store. She loved them, too. Bon Appetit was set up as a temporary exhibit, but it's been so popular that the museum has extended it indefinitely. Now, visitors will be able to study the kitchen with no missing pieces. No doubt, Julia would want you to go home afterward and cook something.
This is Julia Child. Bon appétit.
Bonnie Wolf edits NPR's Kitchen Window and is the author of Talking with My Mouthful. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. The television food show craze is catching on in Pakistan. Cooking shows are proliferating on Urdu and English-speaking channels. While Americans have culinary stars like Rachel Ray, Pakistanis tune in to watch Poppy. NPR's Julie McCarthy went to see the Karachi-based chef whip up a mouth-watering meal.
And then you start talking to the meat guy. All right, rolling and cue.
Cameras trailing, Poppy Aga combs the aisles of this upscale grocery store, shopping for ingredients for the menu she'll feature on her show, A Taste of Fusion. Poppy credits her rise in Pakistan's culinary constellation to her grandmother's kindly cook, who saw in an 8-year-old tomboy the makings of a chef. Handed some basic ingredients, Poppy followed the instructions to a T.
Now, I had no idea what I was making. When it came out, I had the perfect creme caramel in front of me.
Dinner guests mistook the dessert for the family chefs.
And everyone said, oh, Zahusa, the creme caramel was fantastic. And he said, well, I didn't make it. She did. And I had made that thing that had turned these people's taste buds on, you know, on their toes, and that got to me.
Poppy's mission now is to broaden Pakistan's palate. To broaden the audience, she'll tape the show at a local mall, where banners 8 feet high trumpet her appearance, but she won't cook here. With no cooking allowed on the premises, hours before showtime, Poppy races home to her own kitchen to rustle up the meal designed to mark the start of mango season.
We're going to start off with some mangoes. Then I'm going to mix the mangoes with a little crab apple. I'm going to slice up the crab apple in thin, lovely, lovely see-through slices.
There are dozens of varieties of mangoes in Pakistan. Poppy's making up this new recipe for mango salad as she goes along.
A little synthetic vinegar. I'm going to put a little soya in it, a little turmeric, some coriander seed.
Coriander is a staple spice of Pakistani food, whether seeds or powder or leaves. Poppy becomes part chemist, calibrating how to use it.
Coriander seeds in general, they're a hot spice. Coriander leaves are cooling. The chopped coriander that I'll garnish it with will cool everything down. The sweetness in the mango is cut by the chili that I'm going to introduce and the lemon. And at the same time, it's going to sort of secrete all its flavors throughout, so you're going to have a very fruity but a light salad, which is my aim.
The aim hits the mark.
Well, that'll wake up your taste buds.
Yeah. What do you think?
Well, it's delicious.
There you go.
And it's, well, it's a fusion.
Absolutely.
It's sweet, it's savory, it's hot, it's cool.
Yeah.
There's about a million flavors in there.
And they're working.
Poppy has created more than 150 recipes. Her mango chicken papillote for this week's show is no exception. Plump chicken breasts smothered in big chunks of garlic, thick slices of mangoes, and quartered plum tomatoes is the kind of minimal preparation that she says is key to encouraging new cooks.
This is quick cooking. And I'd rather encourage people to cook. You don't need everything to be tiny. You don't always have the time to do something tiny. Mm-hmm. I don't have the time to do something tiny. I've got to get back to the forum and cook.
But she knows she can't rush.
Like I keep saying, you can't dictate to the food. The food dictates to you. Patience. Patience is key.
Back at the Forum Mall, before the cameras, the 33-year-old chef projects a friendly but no-nonsense style that seems to attract the public.
Mango chicken en papillote, ready to eat, and all we have left to do is get someone to taste this, tell me what they think, and it's time for dessert.
Dessert, a cross between a mousse and trifle called mango fool, is the one thing prepared on set.
Then here I have some fabulous whipping cream, and I'm just going to pour that in, and that's about one packet of whipping cream. In that goes. Look how glorious it looks already. I could just eat it like that. And now, for the moment of truth, will the blender work?
Shoppers strolling by are plucked by the show's director to sample the menu on camera.
I think I'm in heaven right now. Have you tried it? It's really good.
Off camera, Rizwana Khalid says she liked the chicken, but says that cooking shows like this exist because they fill a void.
We are entertainment starved nation. I mean, the best way of entertaining ourselves is to come to this kind of a mall.
Miriam Balal says she's a student of cooking shows like Poppy's.
I love watching cooking shows, and I do try it at home for my family, for my kids, for my husband. We really learn from these things. We really do.
But she also says in a society where daily life has been marred by war and terrorism, cooking shows are a healthy form of escape.
Do you feel yourself doing that?
Yes, I do. It really makes me relax when I'm in the kitchen. At least for one time, I'm not getting any news about the blahs and all those things. I'm busy in cooking healthy food for my kids. It makes me happy. Yeah.
Chef Poppy says she understands the allure of the kitchen in these times.
You see, it's practical. Cooking is practical. It's something that everybody does in their households. And there may be war going on outside, but you still got to eat. There are people dying up north, but yet we're doing a cooking show down here.
It's the duplicity of this world we live in, she says, but we do live in it. Julie McCarthy, NPR News.
Last night, Fox Television premiered its new version of the popular reality show The Bachelor with a plus-sized twist. More to Love follows a slate of women who compete for the heart of an eligible young man. But in this version of the show, The Bachelor, a 26-year-old real estate investor, and all 20 contestants are overweight. Unlike shows like The Biggest Loser, More to Love is not built around the idea of losing that weight. Fox says the program shows real-sized people as they really are. But is this inspiration or spectacle? We want to hear from those of you who saw the show last night. Does it perpetuate stereotypes or challenge them? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Joining us now from member station WUCF in Orlando is Marianne Kirby, a self-described fat activist who critiqued More to Love this week for The Daily Beast. And she joined us now. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thank you.
And Fox bills More to Love as inspirational for overweight people. Did you take it that way?
Not nearly as much as they hoped that the fat audience would, I think. It's a problematic show.
You said it was, on the one hand, great to see these, terrific-looking people with curves. On the other hand, you cringed.
Well, I mean, it's good to see fat people on TV, and I think we shouldn't be so afraid of the word fat either. It's also a lot of women crying about how this is their last chance at love, which really does play into this being a spectacle. So while it is great to see fat people on television, when they're portrayed this way, that sort of makes my life harder.
Hmm. You also complained about the extent to which the show was built around shots of food.
Yeah, if you watch the regular version of The Bachelor, there's no food at that cocktail party, much less chicken teriyaki meat on a stick dripping all over their fancy dresses.
And indeed, The Bachelor is shown wolfing down a couple of cheeseburgers.
Yes, that's one of your first introductory shots of him is the cheeseburger shot and the "I like food" line. Uh-huh.
And nevertheless, he is unapologetically fat and says he likes big women.
And I do think that's fantastic. That's sort of the weird tension that happens with this show. There's all of this great message of acceptance stuff, but there's all this backhanded, we're still going to make fun of you, you know, stuff going on in the editing and the casting and the way people are portrayed.
Don't these show make fun of all of their contestants, whether they're fat or not?
On some levels, yes, I think they do. This show, a friend of mine, her line is that it's not that she minds fat jokes. It's just that none of the ones she hears are funny. And we've been hearing the same fat jokes forever. You know, oh, fatties like to eat. And let's move on. Let's find something else. If you want to laugh at me, make it funny, not weak.
But for the most part on TV, people who are overweight play comic relief, the star's best friend, not the star.
Absolutely. Mimi from the Drew Carey Show, Drew Carey himself, Roseanne, if you want to go all the way back to Roseanne. More to Love is a new show as well, along with Drop Dead Diva, which is sort of also a comedy. There's a model who has been sort of reincarnated in the body of a lawyer who happens to be fat.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also a really intriguing show. There's a lot of fat people on television right now, and I see that as a very positive thing. It's just kind of problematic.
Well, let's get some callers on the line. People who've seen the show, which debuted last night on Fox, More to Love. Does it challenge stereotypes or perpetuate them? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And Oven joins us. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, from Sacramento.
Hey, I watched the show, and I have 3 points. My first point being, I don't think it perpetuates stereotypes. I mean, the stereotypes are there whether we deal with them or not. I really think the show is dealing more with reality. There are big people out there who are plus sizes who do deserve to love someone who deserves to be loved. I have two sisters who are plus size, and I want them to be happy. Second point is, I don't think it's so much about being a plus size. I think it's more about being healthy. Are people healthy? People can be really big and still be healthy. And my third point is this. We have a nominee up for Surgeon General of the United States who people are critiquing about being a plus-size woman. They're not looking at her credentials. They're not looking at her background. They're not looking at the community service she's done. They seem to be looking at the cosmetics of it. And I hope one day we can really start dealing with the content of people's character, their heart and their soul, and move on from there. Not everybody fits into that Twiggy cookie cutout, and not everybody's going to be on Men's and Women's Health Fitness magazine. People can be healthy and happy and deserve to be loved.
Nobody's going to argue with that, Oven, but on the other hand, you have to admit that on a collective basis, on a national basis, obesity is a public health problem.
You don't have to admit
agree with you that obesity is a national health problem. Actually, obesity is an international health problem.
Well, that's
and
true.
I think so much as instead of talking about people being plus size, I think the conversation should be, are people healthy?
All right. Let's get back to Marianne Kirby, who wanted to challenge me on that.
You don't have to admit that. The obesity, quote-unquote, crisis is largely a product of the multi-billion dollar diet industry. Obesity levels stopped rising in 2000. If you check the CDC statistics on that, no matter what people say, obesity levels leveled off in the year 2000, 9 years ago, almost a decade ago, and people are still parroting on about, oh, they're on the rise. Also, the way these statistics
whether
are
whether they're rising or not, they are too high.
But you can't say that just based on the BMI, which is what a lot of this stuff is going by, because the BMI is your height and your weight. It doesn't actually measure anything of importance about your body. If you want to talk about health, what we have is a lot of diseases that are correlated with obesity but are not causally related.
Let's move on. Let's get back to the TV show. But Ovid, anyway. Yeah. Thanks very much for the show. There's an email from Devin in San Francisco. If Fox is so concerned with making weight a non-issue, then why did they add the girls' weight near their names on the screen? I thought that was odd.
Is that for me?
I guess it's for you.
Okay, awesome. They did that because, I think, for two reasons. One, so that people can go, oh my God, look at how much she weighs. And two, because nobody knows what weight looks like anymore. You have no idea when you look at a person, like what their body composition adds up to. So there are women on that show. There's one of them. She's 5'10 and 179 pounds, I think was her statistic. And to look at her, I don't think your average person on the street would peg her as fat at all. But according to all sorts of different measurements, she would be.
Let's get Michelle on from Orem in Utah.
Well, I have two things. One thing, I agreed with her in saying that BMI does not determine whether you're healthy or not. A stress test does. Getting on the treadmill and taking a blood pressure, taking a pulse level, taking sugar levels, that's what determines if you're healthy or not. And then the thing I didn't agree about is I don't think that them being overweight, I don't want to be victimized anymore. I don't think, I mean, because there's other Bachelor shows that the men and the women both have said, I'm 35, I'm whatever age, I'm at whatever stage in my life, this may be the last time I have it love. So I don't think it's because they're fat that it's being, you know, glamorized or they're being set apart saying, oh, I'm fat, so no one's going to love me. I think that's too much of a victimization.
And that was something that you also agreed with Marianne Kirby.
Yes.
I'm saying, Michelle, that Marianne agreed with you, but go ahead. Thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Here's an email from Judy in Wilmington, North Carolina. I saw the end of the show last night, and if the intent was to show that overweight women can be just as alluring and glamorous as the size 2 models on The Bachelor, it failed miserably. The focus was still on how fat they were, and they came off as pathetic. The majority of the viewing audience is probably overweight, but I'm sure they have no desire to watch people who look just like them in this type of reality show. We prefer to escape the reality of our own less-than-perfect bodies by identifying with beautiful people. I wonder how you respond to that.
That really bothers me on a lot of levels because it assumes that fat people can't be beautiful. I think that a lot of people, as many issues as there are in this show, as many mixed signals and messages, a lot of people are going to identify with these women because they feel that way. I don't watch reality television on a regular basis, but I'll be watching next week because I feel for these women. There's so much negativity, so many things beating you down as a fat woman in America today, that to have someone tell you you're beautiful and lend you your jacket really can be sort of a revelatory event. And to watch that happen for these women is really kind of powerful.
Here's another email, this from Pat in San Francisco. I watched it as a fairy tale for those overweight and viewed it as a circus sideshow for the thin. I was interested by that comment. Also, I saw some comments to your blog, and that was several people said they were desperately worried that there was going to be a twist, as there often are in these shows, and that some thin competitor would be introduced further on down the show.
Yes, I did a lot of sort of prep work for the article and wound up watching a lot of behind the scenes stuff. And it's interesting how aware of this tension the producers are. They are actively hoping, they've said in interviews, that people will tune in because they're attracted by the spectacle of this and that they will stay because they get to know these women and they want to stay for the story of it.
Well, story is what sells these kinds of shows, and you start rooting for one and against another, and I guess that's how it works. But nevertheless, people are afraid of what the twist might be, whatever it turns out to be. Marianne Kirby, thanks very much for your time today. Marianne Kirby is co-author of Lessons from the Fatosphere, quit dieting and declare a truce with your body. And she joined us today from the studios of member station WUCF in Orlando. Tomorrow, and we're talking to you from NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.